This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
I think the world is going through yet another one of those troughs when coming to human rights. It's been there before and it's risen. But at the moment, I think the world is not in the prettiest of shapes, mainly because governments seem to be receding and a kind of emerging stockade mentality where rather than share problems and share solutions, governments seem to be kind of polarizing.
That was the response of human rights expert John Pace to the question, what is your view on human rights in 2017? When I spoke with him on his recent trip to Aotearoa, John's comment sets the scene for this episode of Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, which looks specifically at human rights in the era of Donald Trump. We're doing something a bit different this episode. We'll hear some more from John as he reflects with me, Sally Carlton, on the state of human rights in 2017. And then we'll get the perspectives of four other guests on Trump's first 100 days in office. This panel discussion was recorded on the 22nd of May as a seminar to the Christchurch branch of the New Zealand Institute of International Affairs and includes an audience question and answer. Many of the themes that John raises in a general sense are again raised by the panelists in their specific reference to the United States under President Trump. But first, getting back to John's interview. John has a hugely impressive human rights biography, which includes decades of work at the United Nations, including several years as Secretary to the Commission on Human Rights. He's also held senior positions in the human rights and humanitarian fields in a variety of countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, Liberia, Indonesia, Sudan, and Cambodia. While this experience makes him supremely qualified to offer an opinion on the state of human rights in 2017, he continued his commentary.
The international activity is on paper quite intense, but in reality, when you come to assess what effect this international activity is having on the ground, unfortunately, there is not as much as one would expect, given the fact that there are so many international agreements and international procedures that have worked reasonably well over a few decades, but there is not as much international interaction as one would wish. Domestically, I think that's connected. There is also a kind of tendency to recede from a more multicultural, communitarian type of approach to government to one which is, I would say, xenophobic, really, even though xenophobia can be less evident in some countries and more in others, depending on the nature and the outspokenness of the leadership. I think there is a tendency ever since governments started to shrink in the 80s for governments to, if you like, lessen their base and as a result of which the political class is no longer really reflecting the kind of representation of people's needs and concerns as it is essentially, as it is mandated to do. The governments are smaller, the private sector is much larger, and in the conditions in which people live are determined more by the activities and policies of the international commercial environment than it is by governments. And moreover, the political class, in my opinion, has in many countries kind of lost the plot in terms of representing the people they're supposed to represent. And in many countries, the political class is just serving itself as it is, and therefore a distance has been created between the needs of people and the way in which their representatives are supposed to address them. In some cases, one can say that the interest in making large profits has acquired the precedence over the need to make sure that people live a fair and a life which they can actually develop their own families, their own culture, their own relations with others. And that's where I think the problem is at the moment.
You mentioned increasing xenophobia and obviously this receding government, but in your view, what are some of the other incredibly worrying human rights trends that you're witnessing?
Well, it's all one world, as it were, because the social shortcomings, the social and economic shortcomings, do also have a kind of reflecting activity in civil and political rights issues, in the need to make sure that the representatives of society do carry out their the obligations for which they are elected to do. So there is, the rule of law, as one would wish to see, is more a subject of theory than practice in a number of governments, in various areas. And that is extremely worrying, because if governments are allowed to get away with this kind of attitude and policies, that weakens the overall fiber of the international community. You know, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, you know.
A huge thank you to John Pace for taking the time during his trip to New Zealand to share with us his views on human rights trends worldwide. As I mentioned earlier, many of the points he raised were also raised by panelists in reference to the United States under Trump. Now we'll hear from these panelists. Firstly, we'll hear from Peter Field, who's in the History Department at the University of Canterbury, and whose research interests include the American Civil War. The second speaker is plastic surgeon Howard Klein, another expatriate American living in Christchurch, who'll focus mainly on the relationship between Trump and his home state of Kentucky. Laurie Siegel-Woodward is the third speaker, and she's going to share her perspectives on the situation as someone who identifies as a self-identified political refugee from the US under George Bush Jr. And she's particularly going to be talking around the idea of women's body rights. Last to speak is Kevin Clements, director of the New Zealand National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago.
Well, it's nice to see everyone here. How should we begin? I can say that Friday afternoon, as is my wont, I was talking with my mother, so that's a good thing in and of itself, in Florida, and she asked me what was I going to say to this group on Trump's first 100 days, to which I answered, I don't know, because we have 3 days between now and then, and surely something will happen in between, which will oblige me to talk in some other way. Trump's in Arabia, and so the press has calmed down, and there isn't much to report of the last immediate news cycle. So I thought I'd focus on, or begin by focusing on, a number that we ought maybe to remind ourselves of. And it's not 100, as in 100 days, or Trump's first 100 days, but the number is 306. After all, it is the number 306 that brings us here today to talk about Donald Trump and his presidency, first 121 days in all. 306 is the number of electoral votes, of course, that Donald Trump won on the Tuesday after the first Monday of November last year. And that's an extraordinary number. 270 is the majority you need to win in the Electoral College to become president of the United States. So Trump not only astonished the pundits, the politicos, and the Clintons by winning the election, but he clearly surpassed 270 by a wide margin. More than that, of course, as I think you know, he won Michigan and he won Pennsylvania to go with Ohio and North Carolina. He won Wisconsin. This is an extraordinary feat. not only is it an extraordinary feat, but I think we should remind ourselves, for those of us, and there were many who thought, no, not Trump, if not never Trump, that surely Marco or Jeb or Rand or someone would surely beat Donald Trump. My sense is that not Rubio, not Bush, not Paul, not any of them would have won those states and defeated Hillary Clinton. So we went from the unimaginable, which is that this candidate, Donald Trump, would be the only candidate that Hillary Clinton would easily beat, to maybe, in fact, exactly the opposite, that Donald Trump is the only candidate who would have broken the blue wall. Now, for those of you not necessarily in the know, the blue wall, right, is the decided advantage that the Democrats have, blue being the color of the states, that tend to consistently vote Democratic. In addition to New York and Massachusetts and California, it is overwhelmingly the states of the Northeast and the so-called Rust Belt that give the Democrats in national elections a great advantage, and Trump, in one fell swoop, destroyed the wall. Maybe he'll build that one between Mexico and the United States. I've long said, too, that if he's going to build the wall, it shouldn't be Mexico who should pay. It should be Pink Floyd. They wrote it. They built it. Anyway, to move on quickly, I would also say this. In trying to evaluate Trump's first 100 days, I'm probably not the best person for a number of reasons, not least of which I was in this classroom earlier today talking about something I actually do know about, the American Civil War and Abraham Lincoln. Once we get past about 1877, I know nothing. In addition to that, just my nature. My nature is one of being something of an ironist. I take a strange, odd view of most things. As an historian, I tend to take a longer-term view of things. And just as myself, living in New Zealand, as my family repeatedly tells me, I can't comment on any of this because I'm not there and suffering as they are with the new president. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not suffering at all, despite this man's craziness. I've got to tell you that the Wednesday night of Trump's triumph was one of the most fun nights I've ever had in American politics. To remind you that politics is only partially policy in the United States. Part of it's just fun. And when everybody's wrong and the people get to occasionally tell the elite, sorry, you got us wrong and we can choose who we want, I find that as fun as the Greek chorus singing in Sophocles' plays. Tragedies, that is. Finally, let me quickly sum up by suggesting this. We know the Democratic Party. We know it well. I'm a Democrat. I come from a long line of what we call yellow dog Democrats, which is if there was a Republican and a yellow dog running for election, my family would vote for the yellow dog. That the Republican Party has been, for much of my lifetime and probably a generation before it, the minority party in the United States. Without a doubt, the minority party. That Congress has been dominated by the Democrats. The Supreme Court has been dominated by the Democrats. And the presidency has been, if not dominated, led by the Democratic Party since Herbert Hoover's ignominious collapse as a Republican with the Great Depression in the 1930s. So from 1932 on, the Republicans have been the minority. That's clearly not true. The last 8 years under President Barack Obama have been a disaster for the Democrats. And with all the nonsense and all the news and all the hype and all the, what should we call it, removal chic of Trump not making it through his first 100 days or first 100 hours or the inauguration, that he's not our president, Trump isn't the issue. The issue is that 38 state houses are Republican, that the vast majority of the governors are Republican, that the majority of both houses of America's national legislature are Republican. And that was hidden a little bit by the presidency, the Democratic presidency of my classmate, by the way, Barack Obama. Now that he's gone and Trump has won, and 306 reminds us only that it is a Republican majority in the United States. And for many liberals and especially for progressives, this is something that is as difficult to digest as anything they can imagine in their political culture. And at the moment, they're not digesting it. If Trump weren't alive, they'd have to invent them so they wouldn't have to look at themselves and try to understand folks from Flint, Michigan, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Case Western, Ohio, said Hillary Clinton, no. Donald Trump, yes.
Right. Well, that'll be quite a hard act to follow. But the good news is I've never met a plastic surgeon that didn't have an opinion about almost anything. I'd like to take a slightly different tone to start, and that is explain why my particular viewpoint about what's happened in America has been colored by how I was raised. Now, at any moment, I can turn on my background accent where I grew up. I haven't talked like that for a long time, but when I go back home, I sure do. Growing up in Kentucky, where everybody goes to church on Sunday, Southern Baptists control what goes on. Most people have a gun and think that's a good thing. That's what life is like in most of America. I think for many of us that don't live in America, there's a real tendency to see America as what goes on in California and what goes on in New York and what goes on in big college campuses, especially in this university setting, which actually does not represent the place that I grew up in. So I'm sorry to say that when I was still living in Kentucky, like seems like 100 years ago, Mitch McConnell had just been elected as a senator. And he was undoubtedly at the time the most miserable young man I'd ever met. It was appalling the things he believed. And now he's the leader of the majority in the Senate. My opinion is he's a bad man. And I don't want to give too much of my own opinion unsupported by facts, but we'll get a chance to figure out people like Mitch McConnell, who's a consummate politician. I think one of the things everyone needs to pay attention with when they're looking at what happens with Trump now is at what point does the support of the leadership begin to fracture? McConnell's been very, very quiet the last couple of weeks since the whole Russia thing has come out and the special counsel appointed. Normally, he's right out there poo-pooing it because most of the Republicans are simply keeping their head down because they can't believe Trump won. They can't believe that he still hasn't brought the whole thing down. And until that happens and he appears to lose popular support, they're not going to be doing anything. They'll be quiet, but they're not doing anything. So it's very curious that Mitch McConnell's been completely quiet. Now, I balance growing up in a place where coal was important, where tobacco farming was important, where people felt under siege for the last 30 years by all the smoke warnings on tobacco packets and the gradual diminution of the coal industry. Just seems like life was getting smaller and smaller and smaller about what they'd been used to. You'd never know that if you were in California, because it never comes up in California. But it sure comes up around the rest of the country. On the other hand, I spent summers with my family in New York. New York's a completely different place. When I listen to Donald Trump talk and close my eyes, he could be anybody I've known for the last 50 years in New York. Everything's the best. When you go to New York, you know something? It's the best. It's the best. I'm going to give you the best suit. I'm going to take you to the best restaurant. Great. Can't get this anywhere else. When you listen to Trump talk, people are used to hearing people from New York talk like that. He's the consummate New Yorker. And so there's this real disconnect in my own mind about how somebody like Trump, who for as long as I know would alienate my family, my mom used to hate to go to New York. She couldn't stand all that New Yorkness, where everything's the best and everything's so brash and everything's right out there and everything's so self-aggrandizing and all that, because it just wasn't the way things were done in Kentucky. So what is it about Trump that has managed to not alienate all the rest of the country? And I think it's this complete disaffection with politicians, and it's all about money. In America, as most of you would know, because I assume most everyone here has either been to America or is from America or spent some time in America, if you are a complete idiot but have a lot of money and are successful, good, because it's all about success. It's all money driven. It's all financially driven. Outside of California, West Coast, Seattle maybe, Austin, a few of those cities like that, you don't hear too much discussion every day about social issues, social good, social justice, et cetera, et cetera. And so the fact that Trump is a successful business person who blows his own horn, or at least appears on the surface to be quite successful, the truth is he's been a bankrupt a couple of times, hasn't been that successful. But, you know, it is one of those things where if you say something, look at Winston Peters, if you say something often enough, right, say something often enough and aggressively enough to the right audience enough, people eventually just take it as a given. So anyway, I disagree with one thing you said about he's overseas, just one. He's just overseas now, and so everything's gone quiet. But I think what we're going to find is that silly speech that he made in Riyadh today is going to be, it's going to be horrible, especially the day after Iran elected a moderate, reelected a moderate. This was going to be our best chance. You've probably seen the reports that prior to leaving, in his notes for his briefing, it had lots of pictures. He's got a very short attention span, apparently. Had to have a lot of pictures. He had to mention himself every couple of paragraphs because he doesn't find it very interesting if he doesn't mention himself. Because no matter what he's talking about, it always comes back to Donald Trump. So it's a very curious thing. I'm ashamed on a lot of levels, but I'm excited on some level to see what happens with the people in America who disagree with that. Where are the changes going to come from now? I wish I could tell you I was tremendously hopeful about that, because the truth is there are more people in the middle of the country than there are on either coast. So I think if there's a fall from grace, it's going to be quite hard, but I don't think it's going to be anytime soon. Anyway, I'm sure we'll talk about this more. Thank you very much.
I suppose I've come really with my background as an American. I have been here for 20 years, so I've been following only loosely the election and its aftermath. My background is having come from the northern part, the northeastern part of the United States, a variety of areas. I then moved to Texas and lived there for 18 years. So I happened to live in Houston for 8, and then I experienced some really interesting shifts from being up north. Being in Boston and the New England area, I noticed that it was much more subtle, the racism and the anti-Semitism. But when I moved down south, wow, there it was. And when I moved to Austin, suddenly I was in this utopia. And we had some liberal people, and it was fantastic until George Bush Jr. became the governor, and I could see the writing on the wall. So it was around that time that I met my husband, and I consider myself a political refugee. I immigrated here as soon as I was legally eligible, and I thought that George Bush Jr. was something to be feared. I had no understanding of what it would soon become. I say soon, 20 years later. The bit that I'm going to speak to is around women's issues, and I think that there is a sort of amnesia that we have when we talk about, with disdain, the global gag rule. So if people are familiar with the idea, Trump has reduced funding, not so much in the amount, but if anybody within the UN Population Fund, and that's to help health causes for NGOs around the world, if any of them in any way discuss or mention or provide abortions, then they are no longer entitled to be funded through this. So this is known as the global gag rule, but this is not the first time that this has happened. Similarly, Title X, which is the funding that is used in the United States to fund things like Planned Parenthood, et cetera, for women's health and reproductive health, they have made it such that the states have choice about who they fund. And if abortion is one of the things that they provide, they have the option of providing it or sidelining it to another health organization. So these are the areas that have caused the most concern for women and women like us in the United States, but this is not the first time it's happened. And I suppose the thing that makes this scarier than in other presidencies is Trump's general lack of regard for women and anything to do with reproductive rights, dignity, those sorts of things. And I'm also aware that under Obama, we had 43% of the people that worked under him were women, and now we're around the 27% mark. As you'll have seen from photographs, et cetera, we have pictures of lots of men signing away women's reproductive rights. So I'm going to leave it there.
Donald Trump campaigned on a policy of America First. I agree with the first speaker. One of the best guides to why he was elected is written up in that nice book called Hillbilly Elegy, which is around, you know, all of the marginalized dispossessed who, for some reason, think that he's going to kind of be their savior, that he'll be able to do the impossible, which is to reverse automation, bring back coal and everything else. But his foreign policy has definitely been characterized by a question on America's First. Being tough or looking tough is his top priority. It was through the election campaign and being dominant. So he has that as an orientation, which I think is a very blunt instrument in terms of foreign policy and so forth. When you ask Donald Trump to reflect on diplomats and others, he says use tough negotiators instead of naive academic people and diplomats who've brought us nothing but trouble. He's learning. So he campaigned on a policy against Hillary and Obama of deep hostility to U.S. alliances, so the whole alliance system. He campaigned on a policy of opposing all free trade agreements on grounds that they were somehow or other inimical to America's prosperity, when in fact I think you can make a good argument that they'd be critical to America's prosperity. He's indicated indifference and, if not opposition, to human rights and democratic regimes, and he's been willing to throw out most of what we can think of as the neoliberal world order. We haven't seen what he's going to do on climate change and so forth, but I think that's a big challenge. So his campaign promises, I think, were pretty disastrous. I mean, they were isolationist in intent, although at the same time he wanted to make America strong and brave and reinforce the military. If you look at his budget proposals, there's been a kind of $157 billion allocation to the military, which is already the nine times larger than the next nine biggest nations in the world. He wants to cut back the State Department. He wishes to slash USAID by 40%. He wants to zero line in his budget support for institutions like the U.S. Institute of Peace and Woodrow Wilson Center. I think, on the other hand, he's also becoming kind of conscious of the fact that he can't just impose his will on the rest of the world, and there's pushback. So his kind of original stance to China to kind of feel that he could impose a two-China policy has been reversed. He's now in favor of a one-China policy. He has the speech he gave in Saudi Arabia is sort of sickening in terms of, you know, what it doesn't say about Donald Trump's own inclinations, but it indicates that, you know, he wanted to get the arms deal through. He's reaffirmed U.S. alliances with Japan and Korea. He's taken a more moderate stance on NAFTA, although he did come up with withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. looking tough is a priority, but it's not a strategy, and it's not generating a coherent foreign policy. I've already mentioned in Saudi Arabia, he's now selling the Saudis billions of dollars worth of weapons, but complains about Iran and nuclear deal when, as the other speaker just mentioned, they just had a democratic election and arguably much more positive orientation towards women than Saudi Arabia. He's let the generals loose, his words, which is a dangerous proposition. The massive ordnance air blast of dropping that bomb in Afghanistan against some dubious targets, I think, is exactly what happens when the generals are in command. He doesn't understand weapons of mass destruction. He doesn't understand nuclear deterrence. He didn't know that America has a nuclear triad. He thinks that there's no point in having nuclear weapons unless you can use them. His foreign policy thus far in the last 100 days is being written on the hoof. It's ill-disciplined, incoherent, and unpredictable. There's no coherent program. On Israel, for example, he said he didn't care whether it was a one- or two-state or even a three-state solution. On questions of human rights and so forth, he's in favor of waterboarding, torture, and interrogation. So I'm going to quote a little bit of what he said about waterboarding. He's called for the resumption of waterboarding, repeatedly expressed his support for the use of torture by the U.S. for the purpose of trying to get information by terrorists. On one occasion, Trump called waterboarding your minimal form of torture. On another occasion, he said nobody knows if it is torture. Whether waterboarding is torture or not, Trump, he supports the laws to allow waterboarding. And this is what he said. Torture works and we'll have to beat the savages. Trump said, I go through a process and get it declassified as a war crime. Certainly waterboarding at a minimum. They're chopping off heads of Christians and many other people in the Middle East. They laugh at us when they hear they're not going to approve waterboarding. And he says, waterboarding doesn't work. They deserve it anyway for what they're doing. So this kind of orientation is an invitation to those who are planning to extreme violence or political violence to go ahead with it, because on the other side, they see no restraint. He aligns himself with dictators like Sisi in Egypt, Erdogan in Turkey, Duterte in the Philippines, in support of Marine Le Pen in the last election. I mean, all of these things constitute, I think, extreme dangers and extreme challenges to the whole notion of what we understand as the United States exercising kind of quiet leadership, a quiet moral leadership, being the city on the hill and so forth. He wants to put on one side the kind of the post-World War order. And he's promised, quote, kick-ass confrontation. We've been losing for too long. The right response, the way to start and keep winning is not to get out of the game, to play it better, smarter, harder, and tougher. And with ISIS, he wants to bomb the shit out of it. Even he has surrounded himself with some, on the political spectrum, some people who are more rational than that. Mardis is Minister of Defense, and Tillerson is as Secretary of State. By and large, I don't think there's any kind of justification right now in terms of assessing the first 100 days to think that the Trump policy position is going to yield order. Japanese and Korean colleagues, for example, have been working like crazy to make sure that he doesn't do anything precipitate in relation to either missile launches or Kim Jong-un's nuclear weapons development. He would be well advised not to kind of sabotage the Iran deal either, because the last thing we need is a nuclear-armed Iran. And similarly, in relation to non-proliferation issues, it would be disastrous if he was to proceed and urge Korea and Japan, although he seems to have pulled back from that now, to develop their own nuclear weapons. So I think that in terms of current progress thus far, I think the missile attack on Syria was a disaster. I think his use of intelligence and blurting out intelligence to the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador to the United States, was a major disaster. He shows no kind of capacity for impulse control, no capacity for thinking altruistically or for taking the shoe of the other in terms of foreign policy positions. And I think he generates a sort of an anxiety, both a rather a worrying kind of fascination. On the one hand, we all wake up to wonder just what new kind of idiocy is coming out of the White House. And on the other hand, we're all kind of nervous and hopeful that the checks and balances, which are supposed to prevail in the United States, will prevail. But it seems to me that at this moment, that we have more reason for anxiety than for hopefulness. If any of you don't know it, you might want to kind of check out a nice website called What the Fuck Just Happened, WTJF. That documents every single policy decision since inauguration. foreign policy and domestic policy. And it just shows you a kind of policies of irrationality and incoherence. Whether over the next 3 years and goodness knows how many days, more coherence is going to come into the system is anybody's guess. But at the moment, when I see Donald in Saudi Arabia, it doesn't give me any cause for hope.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Speak Up Quarter Tier with your host, Sally Carlton. This program is looking at human rights in the era of Donald Trump. And we're listening to panelists discussing Trump's first 100 days in office, recorded on the 22nd of May at the University of Canterbury. The panelists each introduced us to particular elements of Trump's first 100 days in office. The audience was then invited to ask questions, and here they are.
The one horror I'm left with is how America's reputation is being affected. So whatever damage he does in the short term, I feel he's left you with a long-term problem in the way the world looks at you. And I think that's the real damage he's done to your country.
I think that the reputational damage is very great. And goodness knows what's going to happen when he goes to Israel or visits the Pope or knocks on the door of the EU.
Look, I agree with you completely, but I also think it has some substantial foreign policy implications. I think as the rest of the world gets this view, there's a real opportunity for other countries, specifically China, specifically Russia. I mean, choose a part of the world, even in this part of the world, more of a chance for Australia to show whatever kind of leadership they want. And I think that most thoughtful liberal Americans would agree with you. But as I said in my introductory comments, I'm not sure that that represents the population at large, who have seen for a long time the politicians, the people in power, as a privileged elite. I think this is as much a reaction against the perception of politicians as being privileged, elite, disconnected people. None of what you've observed, which is so obvious to us outside of the U.S., are going to move Trump's core supporters. Trump's approval rating now is at the lowest level of any president ever at this point in office. I don't know where that's going to go. He did show some signs 6 weeks ago that maybe he might be learning something, but that's all been turned on its head. He can't resist that tweet storm every time something happens.
I see a conflict here that Trump and a good number of the Republicans, they're puppets for the money that's being spent. On the other hand, the people that they want the votes from are down at the bottom of the heap. My question is, do you see any hope for democracy in America? Because I see it as going out the door and big money talks.
I'd follow the last question. My question is, bearing in mind the disapproval rating that exists at the present time, the lowest of the low, are we likely to see an expression of disapproval in the midterm elections? If it is likely, is there going to be the possibility of a change in the balance of power in the Congress?
I would just like to put into discussion a question about the role of the media. And we look now what's happened with Fox. We here in New Zealand are now exposed more than ever we have been to the role of the American media and the role that the media is playing in the American South.
I think watching Russian television recently, I came across someone said, democracy is impossible in a capitalist system. I thought, wow, really? And as I look at the huge shift in wealth discrepancies in America, where wealth inevitably seems to rise to the issue in those kind of discrepancies, really, is this an undermining of democracy? Is democracy truly possible in a capitalist system?
I have a couple of things to say about media, which is particularly notable in Texas, although I can't specifically speak for other regions. But my parents, who are particularly well-informed, well-educated, it's quite a shock to me, some of the information that they get and some of the information that they don't get. And I mean, just as an example, going back in the time of 9/11, I'm aware that there was no understanding that people were cheering as the Twin Towers went down. So this is something that has always been. This is not specific to Trump. But I'll also let others speak about the interesting monopoly that Fox have had on a number of issues. And for those who are listening to CNN, I'm not sure that the information is that different. I think The Guardian has been probably, again, an oasis in this. But even then...
Part of the problem, of course, is that there's this huge segment of America that genuinely believes reporting by people like BBC, Huffington Post, The Guardian, that's all some kind of liberal plot. Trump, by report, is a cable news television addict. And it's very, very worrying now in America that he could simply say fake news. Anything we don't like, it's just fake news. And he can out-Twitter anybody. The New York Times has reported a 30% increase in their online subscriptions since Trump was elected. So I actually think that for newspapers, Boston Globe, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, some of the really big papers around the country, that Trump has actually been good for media and reporting. And eventually, the pressure they've applied, I believe, were directly responsible for the special counsel that's just been appointed, just holding their feet to the fire. This fake news thing is very worrying. I'd be interested in a historian's perspective because it was very much present with Hitler. I'm not suggesting that Trump is like Hitler, but it's by this massively narcissistic kind of leader trying to play off the press as an enemy of the people, rather than somebody who represents the people. So that fake news or lying press, I think is what's called in the Second World War, the lying press was something that the Nazis used. So the similarities are quite frightening in terms of the media. But I'd be interested in hear you talk about the midterm election numbers, because really one of the disconnects in terms of following American politics and what the House and the Senate say are those guys trying to decide when to keep their heads down so that they can be successful in the 2018 election, since Trump is making such a balls of what's going on now. There's got to be a lot to happen in terms of numbers to change the balance of power. I'd be surprised if it happens. But I think one of the reasons why all of the two houses of the Congress have been really generally quite quiet through what's going on is they're all worried about their political lives. And as someone else talked about the money, you just got to follow the money, where the money comes from. And sadly, I think that's how you figure out American politics.
All right, I'll say a few words. When it comes to funding, we had the second question. I would never be one to not say follow the money. I believe that the Democrats and Hillary Clinton outspent the Republicans by 3.5 to 4 to 1 in the last general election. This is not to minimize money in politics, but I think we've got that backwards. On the question of the midterm elections, I would say there, let's wait and see. It's an uphill climb for the Democrats. On the other hand, generally, the off-year elections after a party in power is run into trouble, and there's a lot of trouble this one's run into, then you're likely to have some reversals. On the other hand, it's going to be very difficult in the Senate, so I wouldn't look for much change there. I don't see a 2010 kind of reversal that we found against Obama. And then to a foreign policy, yes, I'd say here that I read things very differently than my colleague in Otago. I think he's right about everything and yet all wrong. I think Donald Trump is a man in the art of the deal and the art of the comeback that is really quite clever. He has a very specific plan, which is you ask for much more, you aim way farther, and then you pull back to compromise. So he takes president-sized phone call. That was never to reject the one China policy and reverse America's plan. sanctions. It was simply to get China's attention, and I certainly think that he has. And then finally, to take up the question of how should we say the media? I think Donald Trump here is again being very coy and clever. I must admit, as an academic and someone who insists that my students speak more than in one word or 180 characters, but actually try to compose themselves in coherent, grammatical, syntactically logical paragraphs, that I find Trump very difficult to take. On the other hand, 63 million Americans voted for the guy, not because he's an idiot, not because he doesn't understand, but because he does reach them. And while his approval rating is, I believe, 39% today, when you actually ask whom Americans trust more, the president or the press, Donald Trump wins hands down.
There is a kind of indeed a major challenge to democracy, and not only in America, in other parts of the world at the moment. I think Brexit, Geert Wilders, the Netherlands, Orban in Hungary, Duterte, Abe in Japan are all manifestations of basically challenges to the Western democratic ideal. And I think it manifests itself in a number of ways. I mean, one is what happens to democracy when the electorates elect people who are fundamentally opposed to democracy and who exhibit high levels of intolerance? We're in that kind of, you know, classic paradox of tolerance. How do we tolerate the intolerant, and what do we do if we don't want to tolerate the intolerant? That's one element of this. But the more important one is that Donald Trump's instincts and inclinations are profoundly non-democratic. He thinks that he's above the law. He believes to manipulate Comey. He's going to stack federal court systems with his own cronies. I think this is very, very worrying if the legal system is supposed to be a major check and balance on any tyrannical inclination. But I think there's a sort of symptomatic of a wider malaise with the whole Western Enlightenment project. Donald Trump has no commitment whatsoever to Enlightenment principles of truth and scientific endeavor, understand rationality, logic, or any of the things which we've become habituated to. And I think that's one of the challenges in a way. I mean, postmodernism has done its job in a way, and postmodernism, to some extent, is kind of partly responsible for this Trump election. But I think that's one thing. I think there are some fundamental challenges to democracy which we really need to safeguard. In relation to change and balance of power in Congress, I mean, I'm not so certain about that at the moment. I was in the States just 2 days before the election and went from Washington to Harrisonburg, Virginia, where Eastern Mennonite University is located, which is normally a kind of a pro-peace, pro-justice type of institution. But the good Mennonites of Harrisonburg, not to mention all farmers, were Trump supporters because of the stance on abortion and on Supreme Court replacement. So they were voting on single issues like that and hoping that this man who's an avowed anti-feminist and somebody who's not by and large kind of been very pro-family and so forth is somehow or other going to sort of safeguard religion and the family and all the other things that went with that. I hope there'd be a kind of a change in the midterms, but I'm not at all sure that there will be. In terms of the role of the media, I mean, this is one of the other things which I think has been a major calamity in terms of the Trump administration. And God knows what's going to happen. I mean, in terms of alt facts and post-truth and everything else. I mean, this again is another fundamental challenge to Enlightenment principles. I wrote a very anodyne op-ed here in the Daily Times, sort of saying that I was kind of that the inauguration of Donald Trump filled me with trepidation. I got all kinds of hate mail from people in Gore and Southland and elsewhere saying, give the guy a chance. They watch Fox News, and it's clear that the Democratic establishment and the elites and the chattering classes and the academy were all opposed to him and weren't willing to give the guy a chance. And then it went further than that, and they kind of were urging that students in the university remove me from my post. So this man's ability to create kind of climates of intolerance doesn't confine itself to the borders of the U.S. He's created a permissive environment for all kinds of weird things to sort of creep out from underneath stones. And so the whole question of how we reassert, a radical commitment to science and logic and facts and evidence is going to be challenging.
Think of Europe over the last 50 years. They've actually given extra benefits to their population, gradually built up their debt, and then when the 2008 global crisis hit, they did not have the resources to really bail themselves out. And what has happened? You look across Europe, all of your established political parties has been thrown out. UK, the Brexit is across our population. Even the French, the French president hasn't come from a basic party. You've actually got something fundamentally happening.
I think that Trump and the supporters of Trump, to some extent, you know, have flown out of the global financial crisis. And that generated the initial sort of existential insecurity and anxiety that everybody's been feeling. And I think that it also reflects the fact that, you know, we're in a situation of big power transition. You know, a little bit rich to sort of say America, you know, America's great and America's going to be number one again. That means China and, you know, which will arguably overtake the US and the economic growth by 2047 or something, you know, and Japan and others are going to have to sort of find their way in the rankings. I mean, I think the reality is that, you know, the United States, you know, should have a little bit more humility in terms of its kind of aspirations in terms of the global community. The EU, I think, you know, represents a major accomplishment. It may be sort of bureaucratically sclerotic in different ways, but it does represent a kind of an aspiration which, you know, has delivered real benefits to Europe. I mean, in terms of human rights law and in terms of the cessation of interstate violence and in respect for kind of enlightenment principles. So I think that one of the things that we really have to kind of begin thinking about here is how do we nurture the principles and the aspirations which are going to deliver sustainable development, peace between nations, and global justice. Donald Trump doesn't have any interest in any of those issues, and yet they're pretty critical. And goodness knows what's going to happen once he does his bit on climate change. That's going to kind of generate a backdrop against which the global financial crisis will look relatively insignificant.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you've said, but I do think it's probably important to just state what we all know, and that's all politics is local. And so it's all well and good to talk about, you know, America needs to be a good citizen and America is responsible for the GFC. America is responsible for all the misery in the world. But the point is the similarities between what's going on with Brexit and the election in France and what have you is all about local economic positions, people feeling threatened and disempowered. And I think that's what's going on. And I think the frustrating thing about America, for me especially, as someone who lived in America most of my life, and for everybody else, is it's just as good as it is bad. We all enjoy all the great things that have happened in America and all the technology and all the success and all the stuff that gets exported. But it just drives us crazy because when things go wrong there, and especially here in New Zealand, where we feel, I think, especially disempowered often about what goes on financially in the rest of the world, it is just maddening. And so I would just say, in terms of what's going to happen now in America, my view is, I think you have to watch out about what goes on domestically. Because all of these foreign policy moves, etc., are a distraction from what's really bothering people. This repeal of the ACA, the Affordable Health Care Act, is unbelievably traumatic. And I think tax reform, we're only finding out he's going to cut the corporate tax rate from, 35% to 15, something like that. And where is he going to make up the shortfall in the budget? So I think that all of the foreign policy stuff that gets all the dramatic coverage by the media is really serving a distraction for what ultimately may cause him the most trouble at home, and that is how people are feeling in their own pockets.
Well, I'll certainly say this, that living in New Zealand, one of the things I really enjoy is talking about rugby. Because it's one of the few times I get to say, America, a second-rate power.
Well, that concludes this episode of Speak Up Kōrerotia, looking at human rights in the era of Donald Trump. The reflections presented at the beginning of the show by John Pace set the scene for many of the themes raised by the panelists in relation to Trump's America, including the stockade mentality of increasingly inward-facing politics, rising fear of the other at the expense of multiculturalism, the overarching importance of the commercial sector and the impact of economics inequality, and the disconnect of the political elite from the people they're supposed to represent. The panelists also introduced other themes which we should bear in mind as we watch where Trump leads America: foreign and domestic policy decisions, the role of the media, decisions being made about women's and others' rights, and the role of business and money in democracy. Lots to reflect on then. Until next time.